From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday morning, May 21st, 2020. And I've got a full show of interviews lined up for you this morning. And also always hoping for some listener calls to contribute to the conversation and ask questions and so on that maybe I'm not thinking of. That happens a lot, by the way. I just want to remind you all of that. And we're going to be starting off with the Speaker of the House, Mitzi Johnson, and then Senate President Pro Tem Tim Ash. Going to be asking both of them to react to an announcement yesterday from the Scott administration of a $400 million economic stimulus package. They're using a lot of this money that's coming down from the federal government in the COVID-19 relief situation, and they've decided to earmark it for a whole range of programs within the state. And we're going to be talking to, it's all going to be approved by the legislature, so we're going to be talking to the two leading lawmakers, those being Speaker Mitzi Johnson and President Pro Tem Tim Ash, a little bit later in this hour. We'll be talking to Senator Ash, and we'll be getting their reactions and maybe also getting caught up with some of the recent doings of the Vermont legislature with the two leaders. Later on in the program, we're going to be having a three-way, three people on the phone with us. So I guess it's four-way because I'll be in the conversation as well. Maybe five-way if listeners are calling in. We'll see. It's going to involve Alan and Lynn LaHoulier. They own a business called Johnson Hardware and Rental, and they have been plagued by repeated thefts by the same individual, and they are. Really worried about this young man who apparently has, from what they tell us, they think a drug problem, and is someone who is not getting the attention that he needs from a court system and a justice system, which is largely on very limited business in Vermont because of the COVID-19 crisis. And so this is one of those situations where they're telling me that these problems have festered for a long time, but perhaps have worsened in recent months. A lot of the longstanding social problems, it's a constant theme on the Dave Graham Show, a lot of longstanding social problems have been kind of laid bare and maybe worsened a bit and maybe made to be noticed more by the COVID-19 crisis. So we'll be talking about this aspect of the justice system with the hardware store owners in Johnson, the LaHouliers, also with Lamoille County Sheriff Roger Marcoux, and the News and Citizen reporter who's been writing about this, Tommy Gardner, familiar voice on WDEV, is the former editor of the Waterbury Record, now a little farther north in the journalism world in Vermont, so up there in the Morrisville area. All right, well, let's get right into our first conversation here with House Speaker Mitzi Johnson. I believe she's on the line, and Speaker, Madam Speaker, I very much appreciate you joining me this morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Hey, I wanted to check in with you to find out your thoughts. I saw a statement from you. I thought we'd get some maybe straight from you instead of pixels on a screen to what you think about the Scott administration's proposal to spend $400 million in two phases in Vermont to try to get Vermont's economy going again post-COVID-19. Do you like what you're hearing from them?
Well, so I do think it is time for a significant injection of the federal money into Vermont's economy to, as we begin to open up, get us moving, get us back to work, and get things right. I actually haven't seen the proposal yet. I had probably a 3 or 4 minute conversation with the governor on it, just with some very high level talking points on it. So I actually can't speak in detail on it because I don't know what's in it. It's supposedly going to be revealed next Tuesday, I think. But we're getting committees ready to clear some of their schedule, to take this up very quickly, and look at what are the critical things, you know, for phase one to make sure that businesses have what they need to reopen, and then think about kind of a phase two in terms of building our building out our infrastructure to both get people back to work, deal with some of the COVID problems that, as you said, pre-existed this current crisis, but COVID has laid them bare, and figure out which things can we invest money in now that will then lead us to a stronger 21 and beyond.
Now, one question I had about this, just and again, very high level kind of headline question, really. I mean, I'm looking at the VT Digger headline. For instance, it says Scott administration outlines $400 million economic relief plan. And I know that the state is has been in line to receive $1.25 billion from the federal government. And I'm wondering, and I know some of this money is going to hospitals and so on. Perhaps it's already spoken for. But $400 million out of $1.25 billion, I believe that leaves about 850 billion dollars, at least not spoken for, at least in today's coverage.
You're missing something like 200 to 225, something like that, million dollar chunk that went through the joint fiscal process. That's the piece that went to hospitals to set up emergency relief funds to set up our emergency response center, and so we're about at half then.
Yeah, and so do you think it's wise to sort of hold back on some of this money in terms of just what are the curveballs we're going to get thrown later on, and maybe have some left to respond with?
Well, the other big question remaining is if Congress will eventually allow us to use some of this money to help fill the holes in the education fund, the transportation fund, the general fund, just for basic state government. We certainly don't want the hole caused by reduced sales taxes, reduced rooms and meals tax, and the postponement of remittance of all those taxes to all of those funds go into the education fund. All of the sales tax and 25% of the rooms and meals tax goes into the education fund because businesses don't have to remit the collection of those taxes, anything they might have collected. They don't have to remit those until the new fiscal year. We have an enormous problem in the education fund, and we want to make sure that problem in the education fund does not wind up on the backs of property taxpayers. And so right now, the federal government has not allowed the use of that money to be applied to any kind of holes within state revenues. But there is quite a bit of talk of them opening that money for that use. And so and so we want to make sure that we've been prudent in our spending to make sure that we get a good chunk of money out into the economy to get people to work and restart the economy, support businesses, support workers. But we also want to make sure that if Congress turns around and says, yep, go ahead, use it, that we can use it to like solve that big problem in the education fund or the hundreds of millions of dollars that the general fund is supposed to be short.
Yeah, those are big holes in the state budget, and I'm sure that property taxpayers around Vermont, many of whom are frankly already hurting. You know, if I'm out of a job and I've been having trouble getting the partial payment you get against your regular pay from the Department of Labor via the Unemployment Insurance Program, some folks are still struggling to get that kicked off, I would think that people don't want to hear right now about a giant increase. They don't want to hear any time about giant increases in their property taxes. But certainly that is a worry.
Well,
that
I would think. We don't want to institute one.
Yeah, I get you.
That's a shared feeling. So that's why we are holding some of that money back, and we'll allocate it in August. When we have clearer rules from the federal government. Because they've been toying with states, and B, when we have clear projections of what the updated forecasts are, because we don't have any of 2019's income tax returns, or we don't have the complete set of income tax returns yet, because that got pushed back to July. So we don't even have a kind of sense of what that looks like, what income tax withholdings for this year so far look like. And so we will have a much better idea of those two things in August to be able to deploy the rest of the money. But we do want to make sure to give a really good injection of money into the Vermont economy, to get things going again.
Yeah, I think there's a real hunger out there. I'm curious to ask you your general impression of, do you think this problem, the problem of people really struggling out there and feeling just under the gun, may be worse than a lot of us even imagined by virtue of what we saw with these food distribution sites? The one in Berlin last Friday was absolutely overwhelmed, and I guess there was a huge traffic tie-up in Middlebury yesterday as well. Do you have any sense that maybe the degree to which Vermonters are in pretty desperate straits is even bigger than people thought?
I would completely agree with that. The constituents that I'm talking to on a daily basis are people who have not had any kind of income now in, 9 weeks we're going on? Or are we going on 10?
I've lost track,
you know,
I must say.
Remember all the conversations that we've had about the number of Vermonters living paycheck to paycheck and the number of Vermont households who could not afford a $500 emergency. Well, that $500 emergency evaporated, you know, somewhere around March 20th, 25th, you know, weeks or days after the economy shut down. And the Department of Labor, while everybody there has been working incredibly hard, there have been major holdups. I think the administration didn't get as many people, you know, trained up and on point there as quickly as they could have. And it's meant that I still have constituents who are still waiting for an unemployment check over 2 months later. And we have, you know, we're trying to work in partnership with the administration. A lot of legislators have volunteered to help people navigate that system and help get claims resolved and help collect information for Vermonters. But if you go on the legislative website, there are links to the new YouTube channels that will allow you to see the question and answer that the All House Caucus, all parties had, first with Secretary Brittany Wilson and then with Commissioner Harrington about what we're seeing and what their plans are to improve those. And most recently, just a few days ago, Commissioner Harrington urged people to continue to reach out. If you haven't heard, if you've been waiting for DOL to call, don't wait anymore. Call them back. And I realize that is sending people into another level of extreme frustration of wait times and getting answer, you know, getting somebody on the phone who is not well trained and may not know all the answers. But I think in some cases, if DOL had a wrong email or a wrong phone number, that some people are not getting that call back, and so the call volumes have gone down. There are a lot of unemployment and self-employment, pandemic unemployment assistance issues that are being resolved now. So please reach out to the Department of Labor and continue to try to work with them if you're having any of those issues.
Yeah, that's that is something where folks kind of have to be persistent here and really stay with it. And you know, it's unfortunate. I think if there's any one upside for individuals out there who are struggling with this, you can almost imagine, you know, this is going to take some hours, but maybe not only is the income replacing work, but the phone calls might be replacing work as well. I don't know if there's any sort of solace there or whatever, but you know, that is one thing where if you're unemployed, you have time, a lot of time. So, which is, I know it's not a happy thing because people want to get back to work.
Well, but, and you don't necessarily have time if you are now providing homeschooling and full-time child care.
Good point.
And managing, a lot of difficult home dynamics with people getting increasingly frustrated and stressed and on each other's nerves. And, you know, and so this has affected people in wildly different ways. If you are able to work from home and there, you know, and there aren't, and you don't have children in the house, that's sort of one set of problems. But if you're trying to manage a few school-aged kids or an infant while you're trying to potentially manage a job or you lost your job and you're needing to spend hours and hours and hours trying to get through a very complicated, bureaucratic, heavy system with Department of Labor and all of the federal regulations involved. This is real. This is frustrating, and there are a lot of people who are just tipped over the financial cliff with this. But if there's any way that people could sort of muster a little more strength to work with a bunch of the Department of Labor employees and all of the various other state employees that have volunteered to jump in. To help with some of these calls, it is, once you get through, it is worth it. There is a paycheck, an unemployment check that has been supplemented by the federal government, and this is money that will help you, you know, get through the rest of this and pay off some of those bills and get you back on your feet. But we've got to
get
through to the system.
Well, let's hope that the help is real and that it is as effective as it can be. Folks, my guest is Mitzi Johnson. She is the Speaker of the Vermont House of Representatives. She's a Democratic representative from the Lake Champlain Islands. And we welcome calls from listeners. If you have any questions or comments you'd like the speaker to hear, here's your chance. 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And I really appreciate the speaker taking some time out of what I'm sure is quite a busy and sort of mixed up and unusual schedule for you these days, Mitzi
that.
Johnson. Let me actually ask you, try to insert a little bit of normalcy here. I've been reading lately that after some talk of earlier in the first phases of this COVID-19 crisis in Vermont, you and other legislative leaders were saying we're really going to focus just on COVID-19 related legislation, and then of course the annual budget for the state, you know, the really and probably the Capitol bill, you know, the really sort of must pass legislation we have. But now there has been some rekindled interest in other issues, and what's on the agenda? What's likely to pass this year? And how long is all this going to take? How late into the year will you folks still be meeting in the 2019-2020 biennium?
That is the question on everybody's mind at this point, certainly for those of us in the middle of it. So the plan all along was for March and April to focus on COVID bills strictly. And then if committees were through with their COVID bills, just to help them get used to the technology and settle into what a committee meeting on Zoom was like, then they could continue from some of their work prior to COVID. But on the floor with the whole House debating and voting on bills for March and April, we were very clear those are COVID only. And then in May, as planned, we began to open that up a little bit to some of the other bills that we had wrapped up work on and were ready to vote on and send over to the Senate. Our priorities continue to be any COVID bill, any deadline bill, legislation that has a sunset at the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, or that needs to be extended, or any more complex previously passed legislation that has an implementation date of July 1 that we need to push back because state government doesn't have the capacity to do it right now. And so we are, again, focused on COVID bills, those deadline bills, and then the major money bills. It's the money bills that are totally driving the time train here. Our first energies are going to making sure that they stay right on track, move along. We just got the governor's recommended budget yesterday. We're on Thursday now, so 2 days ago. Hard to keep track, we're all finding. So we just got that recommended budget, so we've just begun work on it. We will work as efficiently as our due diligence allows, and when those money bills are done, we are adjourned for the summer. And so, you know, it'll be mid to late June, but again, we're very focused on those critical must-pass bills. As we have time or as there's committee capacity, then we will fit in other things, you know, as we can. But none of them are displacing the work on the money bills. Those bills have to be in place by July 1st. We will then break. And then, remember, I told you about how all of the taxes, income tax, sales tax, and meals have been pushed back to, for remittance and submission in July.
Right.
That means that we will need some time to, our state economist will need some time to analyze that data and look at where we are with the economy writ large, where we are with COVID, and make some good estimates about what we think the economy is going to do over the next year. So we will have that data by mid-August, and so then come late August, early September, we will be back to finish up a three-quarter year budget. But the budget that we're working on now is only one quarter of the fiscal year, which is very unusual.
Right.
But because the federal government is not providing any kind of clarity for us, and because of all of the revenue source unknowns, we're passing a one-quarter year budget to get us through September, and we'll be back in August for a few weeks to do the remainder of the budget year.
Okay. Let's bring in a caller. We have Dee from Duxbury on the line. Good morning, Dee.
Morning. I'm just really glad to hear the money talk, but also the thought about unintended consequences of lockdown, like loss of money, people not getting health related, like cancer testing, etc. You know, there are a lot of, and you know that there are a lot of people that are hurting. I mean, we're doing okay. My husband's still working, but I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's just sad.
Yeah, it's really a tough time, and I hear the anguish in your voice, Dee, and I share it. I mean, I think that there is a world of hurt out there, and it's tough to really figure out, you know, how exactly it's all going to resolve. But got to keep working through it together, and hope that we can at least alleviate, you know, some of the economic suffering out there, as well as just the anxiety and the stress. And, you know, you were talking, Speaker Johnson, about people having these stresses in families that result in I think a gentle way to put it, which you did, was talk about people getting on each other's nerves. You know, it's a stressful time for many, many people, and most people, I would say. You know, let's hope that folks are reaching out to friends and family and publicly available services when they need to make sure that they're managing these stressors as well as they can. So, Dee, thank you for the call. I think you're right on. So that's great. Mitzi Johnson, Speaker of the Vermont House, I'm wondering also your sense of state-federal relations. I mean, we hear these noises out of Washington that the president may crimp aid to states based on states annoying him politically or something.
It is horrific and unconscionable. You know, I think we would have a much more successful outcome here with fewer deaths, a shorter economic shutdown, and a much faster recovery if we could work in unison. And I know in the absence of that sort of leadership in Washington, Governor Scott has been working with other neighboring governors so that you know, we could somewhat keep the Northeast on a similar page.
Some sanity there. That's much needed. Yeah.
And I'm very appreciative that he's doing that. It's I think Vermont. The good news in all of the insanity and the president's completely immoral threats are that we're a small state.
Mr. Johnson, I got to interrupt. I'm really sorry, but we're about out of time here. Really appreciate you coming on the air with me, Mitzi Johnson, Speaker of the Vermont House. Thank you so much. All righty, we're going to take a brief bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. Tim Ash is coming up on the other half hour of this first hour.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into the second half hour of our program this morning, Thursday, May 21st, 2020. And I want to continue on our theme of getting a couple of senior legislative leaders to talk about the big announcement from Governor Phil Scott yesterday about his version of an economic stimulus package for Vermont, using federal money that came down recently in the face of the COVID-19 crisis. Vermont got about $1.25 billion yesterday. The governor said he wants to spend about a third of that on a wide range of programs, mainly geared toward getting small businesses back up and running, getting folks to square away maybe some housing problems, back rents and back mortgages or whatever that have popped up during this time of economic dislocation. And we had House Speaker Mitzi Johnson on in the first half hour to talk about her take on the situation. Let's get the word from Senator Tim Ash, Democrat of Chittenden County and the president pro tem of the Vermont Senate. And Senator Ash, before I go further, refresh me on the do I have the designation right? Is it a PD or a DP or just a D these days, or what are you doing party wise?
Well, I've been called everything, usually not politely, but I serve as a Democrat progressive, so okay. I run in the Democratic primary and have been nominated also by the progressive, so DP.
Okay, got it. Yeah. Just have to double check because those little factoids have a hard time finding a slot in my brain to settle it and be retrievable immediately. So I knew you weren't an R, so that's a start. Anyway,
I got their nomination a couple times, but.
Oh, really? Oh, so DPR, right. Yeah. Probably working families.
It seemed a little much, so yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. But let me ask you. Your initial thoughts about the governor's announcement yesterday, do you think he's heading in the right direction?
Well, I think, you know, obviously we have to do something to shore up our small business community. So in that sense, yes, it's unsurprising. Many of us have been in conversations with the governor directly and his team saying we've got to band together and save a lot of small businesses from going out of business altogether if the primary problem they're facing is COVID-19. Obviously, we're not in a position to be fixing every business's problems that might have pre-existed, but revenue losses as a result of business closures through the last 2+ months, we have to figure out a way to make sure entire sectors don't either partially collapse or collapse altogether. So hospitality and lodging, we know they've been suffered massive revenue loss. And while many of the employees have qualified for unemployment, and but many of these small businesses have really not been able to rely on the federal relief programs for small businesses very effectively. So the people who've poured their heart and souls into, you know, starting and running their small businesses in some ways have been left more vulnerable than anyone else. And that's exactly the group that I think we need to make sure we're helping out.
Yeah, because obviously these small businesses are they are employers. They are people who provide an awful lot, in the aggregate, an awful lot of jobs. I mean, they may have, you know, 20 or 30 or 40, 50 employees in each individual business, which doesn't sound like it's a huge amount in the overall economy, even in a small state like Vermont. But when you start looking at them in the aggregate and saying, you know, take 30 employees and multiply that by, you know, a couple thousand businesses, and pretty soon you are talking about a real impact here. And you've got to keep in mind the impacts on individual lives out there and families and, you know, people's ability to take care of other aspects of their lives, which also affect small businesses. I mean, think of somebody who was, I don't know, paying off maybe a builder who did some work on their property over the, you know, last summer, and the payments were supposed to continue through the winter, and all of a sudden there's a job loss, and then what? And so,
yeah,
then
the ripple effects are really significant. And you've just given one small example, but then of course that builder owes someone else money for the materials that he or she bought, and then it just continues along down the line. And I think the vulnerability, you know, taking the food, you know, the restaurant and lodging industries as an example, there are some regions of our state and some communities in our state who are really dependent on tourism. And if you take those 30 employees at 5 to 10 different locations, that might be the bulk of the employment in that community. So it's particularly important for those communities who are tourism dependent that we find a way to get these businesses through the worst of it, so that they're ready to run when we can open things up more fully.
And yet, it's got to be a very difficult thing for any kind of a government program to. And this is a problem common to a lot of government programs where you're dealing with individual cases and you're trying to follow sort of consistent rules so as to be fair to everyone involved, you know. And so the thinking about aid to small businesses, well, look at the vast array and of small businesses, the differences among them, the numbers of employees, the type of work they do, the, you know, how sort of crucial are they to the economy. I mean, on and on it goes. There are so many. So how do you actually parse that and not have it be completely subjective and or not sweep everybody under some big bureaucratic machine?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, we've seen, for instance, with the federal boost for people who collect unemployment, whether they're typical employees or self-employed or independent contractors, the federal government said anyone who qualifies will get a $600 a week boost from the federal government. Obviously, that's, you know, much welcomed by all the people who are receiving it, but it tried to apply a one-size-fits-all $600 boost to someone who might have only qualified for $1 of unemployment or someone who qualified for the highest, you know, weekly amount of unemployment. So it created equity issues by virtue of being simple. And I think that that we have that balancing act that we have to face using this federal money that we've gotten that the governor intends to use in his proposal. Do we provide one benefit to everybody, which is the simplest to administer, but will create a number of inequities and perhaps doubly reward one entity who already is at the table with some other federal program? Or do we try to micromanage and have a customized benefit for every single business, which, of course, we've seen how our Department of Labor has handled what it faced. I highly doubt the state is in a position to do an overly complex, highly engineered, business unique approach. So we'll be having to do that balancing test and make sure that we're being as fair as possible with the least administrative, red tape so we can get because the most important thing at this point is we got to get money out the door.
Yeah, I really sense that the folks out there are really feeling this and are getting desperate, frankly. Speaking of which, I asked this question of Mitzi Johnson a little while ago, but I wanted to get your thoughts as well. Was that the impression you got that maybe the troubles out there are deeper than we know? When you saw media coverage of last Friday's food distribution in Berlin, and then of course there was one this week in Middlebury that also apparently was oversubscribed and just caused traffic jams and so on. What are your thoughts there?
Well, we're everything has happened so quickly, and state and federal government, for all of what it does well and all the warts and things it doesn't do well, is not used to making many, many dozens of significant policy and spending changes in a matter of just 2 months. And so, for instance, one of the things we still have to figure out is once it all sugars out and we see who has received the various unemployment add-ons of $600, how many people have actually had their income go up? How many have had their incomes go down? And then how long can they count on that level of income support? How many small businesses have seen their revenue decline 20%, 50%, 75%, or almost entirely 100%? Those are all things that are still gray areas, although we know the picture is bad. Seeing people in lines at state airports, I was at the National Guard distribution at the Allenbrook School in Williston and down at Gifford Medical Center, where the hospital there distributes fresh food. And the lines are huge. And what you can clearly see is there are really a few different categories. There are those who are desperate and very badly need to meet their basic needs for themselves and their families. You also have people who are clearly worried about how long this is going to last. And so they're stocking up because that's the piece that while we're in crisis mode, the governor and those of us in legislative leadership have to take a step back and say, this economic disruption, it's not something that even if we all go back to normal in 3 or 4 months, that it just goes away and everything's back to normal. The economic consequences of this could last a couple fiscal years. So just like many families are saying, well, wait, if this economic strain could last a while, we need to stock up now on non-perishable goods so that we have it available months down the road. State government also has to be taking both the short view in terms of immediate protective measures for our economy, but starting to think about not just getting through the next year, but how do we position ourselves for this year and the year that follows?
Well, and then going into the future, I've read all sorts of stuff recently, wide variety of magazines and even local commentaries in the papers here in Vermont and so on, where people talk about how fragile, frankly, this robust economy, the best economy we've ever had, according to the President of the United States, as of January and February, how it this admittedly big challenge was able to knock it over, frankly, pretty easily. And so to me, I wonder if there are some underlying weaknesses there that could be somehow shored up in the long term, to so that if the next pandemic comes in, say, 2025 or something, we won't be just completely knocked off the saddle, you know.
And one of the pressures that a state like Vermont has really faced for the last 20, 30 years is our national trade policy, which has basically enriched companies and starved communities. Communities across Vermont used to have manufacturing that provided a great middle-class income with benefits for people who only had a high school diploma if they hadn't gone on to further their higher education. All that has effectively been wiped out, that kind of core manufacturing base. And now we do have specialized manufacturing, and we're very grateful for the work they do. But what's happened is so much of the supply chain has moved to China and other countries overseas that we see the consequences of global trade at the, you know, to benefit the owners, but not the communities that have created that value in the first place. So that's one area which has really exposed the weakness of our economy. Income inequality, which is a term that you know, people with different political philosophies will debate, but obviously the number of people in Vermont and throughout the country who are one crisis away from not being able to pay the bills, well, we're in that crisis. And so here we find ourselves providing rent support, moratoriums on eviction and foreclosures, because all of those statistics that in good times we talk about but don't have to worry about so much, about how vulnerable people really are to an economic crisis, we're seeing all that play out right now. And Vermont, you know, in some ways is always swimming or moving into headwinds from national policy. And we do the best we can, but fundamentally, the national, our federal government, our Congress, and our president have to really change their priorities. Otherwise, if some other, you know, economic or natural disaster befalls us a year from now, we'll be back in the exact same situation.
Yeah, I mean, it really has struck me the degree to which I think everybody or a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people assumed that, you know, even if they were struggling individually or whatever, we had this economy that was going to be, pretty, not only was it strong, and you know, certainly a lot of people were buying the line from the president that it was the best economy ever. I'm
right.
Not sure I was, but or you were, but a lot of people were. And meanwhile, you know, again, along comes this challenge, which, you know, if anything or any person or anything is as strong as our economy was alleged to be, you would think it would be able to withstand this kind of a challenge to a greater degree than it seems to have.
Dave, I was just speaking to a older Vermonter who was born and raised during the Great Depression, who was a dyed-in-the-wool FDR supporter and thought Herbert Hoover was the single worst president and maybe person in U.S. history, at least in the political world. And recently in describing the complete lack of empathy and competence of our president, said that if the choice was Donald Trump or Herbert Hoover, she would reluctantly have to vote for Herbert Hoover. And I thought that was, in a way, the ultimate analysis and of the Trump presidency and its handling of this and its complete, you know, its complete detachment from what a normal human being is experienced right now.
Well, I think that maybe I think a lot of Vermonters are probably going to be pleased that we don't have to choose between Donald Trump and Herbert Hoover. So let's look at the bright side. Tim Ash, I'm wondering, though, are you worried when you hear comments from the federal government and speculation in the national media about the possibility that some federal funding could be made contingent on policy prescriptions being written by the president, things like immigration policy and so on. You know, Vermont has been fairly progressive on the whole idea of fair and impartial policing. And I don't know if we really qualify as sort of a sanctuary in the form of like the sanctuary cities people talk about. But President Trump clearly doesn't like those things. And he's talked about trying to limit federal funding to states that, I guess, annoy him politically. Is that a worry?
Well, it's not. I mean, it's not just a worry. It's an embarrassment, and it's just shocking. I mean, I think everybody is totally fatigued with dealing with this president. Even his supporters are probably worn out by his antics. But what I think the president could do is begin by saying that he mourns the loss of 100,000 Americans to COVID-19, and say that his first order of business is to make sure people are safe and healthy, and that we're going to rebuild our economy, then get back to political fights. This is the first president in probably history, including Herbert Hoover, I should add, who has not even expressed a morsel of concern for the well-being of people throughout our country. And I think, you know, the idea that, you know, controversial policies would be tied to receiving federal money to save people's lives and get our economy back on its feet and support small business owners who have poured their hearts and souls into their work, often fighting against Goliaths like, you know, Trump International and all these other places. I just think it's completely shocking. But as I say, it's not super productive for us to focus on President Trump at the moment. But hopefully our congressional delegation can snuff out any of those kinds of antics. And hopefully some of the leaders in the Senate on the Republican side will understand that their reputation and legacies are not going to be tied, will not look very good if they continue to defend this president's actions while people in their states are suffering. It's just, it would have been unthinkable 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 5 years ago. It's only in the last 3 years that we can even contemplate this kind of abuse.
I'm wondering, in terms of the nuts and bolts of what the federal government might be doing and so on, I was talking, we had Speaker Johnson, Missy Johnson, on in the first half hour, and she mentioned that there is this concern that the state wants to use some of the federal money to plug holes, for instance, in our education fund and keep property taxes in check to the extent possible. Currently not allowed, I guess, under the strictures of the federal funding formulas. Are those likely to change? Can those be? Can Vermont and other states appeal for more flexibility? More flexibility there. And by the way, just about a minute to go. So,
well, I think that I'm hopeful that that we will be given the flexibility to use it to help meet budget needs if we choose to. Right now, the eligible uses are fairly restrictive. Very little guidance came about how we could spend the money. The federal government and different agencies of the federal government keep issuing guidance, which sometimes is more confusing than clarifying. But frankly, we're in an awkward position. We have to plan as if we cannot use the money flexibly while hoping that there'll be a change and we will be able to use it flexibly. That's something that's handicapping the work of both the governor and the legislature as we think about this. But frankly, states all across this country, whether they're blue or red or purple, we're all in a state of economic shock right now. So it's my hope that reality will sink in for members of Congress and they will do everything they can to explicitly allow states to use the funds as they see best.
All right. Well, Senator Tim Ash, President Pro Tem of the Vermont Senate, I thank you very much for joining me this morning. Let's do this again soon.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
All righty. We are heading into a top-of-the-hour break for some CBS news, and afterwards we'll be talking to one of our CBS correspondents for a few minutes about some of the stuff going on the national scene, and then subject turns to a crime spree in Lamoille County. We'll be back, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and we're going to be talking in just a couple of minutes to Stephen Portnoy of CBS News, and then a little bit later to three people from the Lamoille County area. There's a nasty situation there where a fellow from the Johnson area has been plaguing local businesses with shoplifting and petty crimes, and the folks up there tell us they can't seem to get the attention required to stop this from happening from the court system. And we're going to be talking with Roger Marcoux, the Lamoille County Sheriff, Alan and Lynn Lahouillier. They are owners of the Johnson Hardware and Rental Shop. And we're going to also have Tommy Gardner on, a longtime voice on WDEV. He is currently a reporter and editor for the News and Citizen in Morrisville, has been covering this story. It's a pretty interesting case, and I think is illustrative of some longtime struggles in the justice system that have really been laid bare recently by the COVID-19 crisis. But I believe we, if I'm lucky and understanding what's going on. No, I'm actually told Stephen Portnoy is not quite with us yet. I did get an email a couple minutes ago from a listener who was asking me where I had seen reports of Donald Trump, the president, threatening to withhold funding from states that were doing things that he didn't like politically. There's something just from CBS News within the last 24 hours, the headline of which is Trump threatens states over expanded access to mail-in voting. And it says, okay, well, maybe we can talk with Stephen Portnoy about all this. Stephen Portnoy of CBS News joins me. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning to you, sir.
And I wanted to check in with you about a story that actually has gotten a little bit of discussion on the show so far today, and which it has to do with, I was asking a couple of senior legislators here whether they were worried about Vermont possibly seeing some of the funding it's been getting in the COVID-19 crisis from the federal government being threatened because the president of the United States might be annoyed with Vermont if we really push mail-in voting, or if we are too friendly to immigrants, or any of the other sort of ancillary or non-involved political issues, at least non-involved in the COVID-19 crisis. And I'm wondering, CBS actually just had a story about, I think it was a couple of states, Michigan and Nevada, I believe, We're getting worried about possible cuts in federal funding. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, these are threats the president is himself making, mainly on Twitter, talking about seeking a cut in federal funding, or at least asking about one. I don't know whether he would ask Congress to somehow pare back funding for certain states, or whether he would seek to do something administratively. Yesterday, the press secretary in the White House talked about alerting the head of OMB to the president's concerns, which suggests that maybe some kind of maneuvering might be done within the administration. But you know, time was, Republicans used to talk about states' rights and the ability of a state to chart its own path and do its own thing. The particular concern the president has is that these states, Michigan and Nevada, led by a Democratic Secretary of State, who controls the elections, sending out applications for absentee ballots to all of the voters in the state of Michigan. Republicans are arguing that absentee balloting, voting by mail, offers the potential for abuse, even though the White House, defending the president's views on this, doesn't point to any specific incidents of this occurring to a significant degree, and it simply suggests that there's the potential for fraud without any evidence that fraud has occurred on a wide scale.
Yeah, and they've looked pretty hard for fraud, of course. So there was that special panel appointed by the president, headed up by Chris Kobach of Kansas a couple of years ago to try to examine possible nefarious dealings in the 2016 election, and actually gave it up after some period of time of investigating. And I think the upshot was that there was really nothing there to investigate. Is that right?
Well, sure. You remember that when the president took office, he was not of the mind that he did lose the popular vote. The sum total was I think something like 3 million people, 3 million more people in the country didn't vote for Donald Trump, but instead voted for Hillary Clinton. Of course, that's immaterial mm-hmm. when it comes to the Electoral College. But the president believed and argued that it was illegal immigrants who were voting, and were it not for that, he says, he would have won the popular vote. So that's why he appointed that voter fraud commission, which, as you note, disbanded without finding any fraud at all.
Yeah, I guess, and this difference in strategy or in policy over whether mail-in voting is a good way to go. I'm wondering if there's a nexus here at all with economic relief funding tied to the COVID-19 crisis?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, this is the specter the president's raised. I can't think of any circumstance in which the Congress would appropriate funding with the House in Democratic hands without money going to all of the states. I can't see a circumstance in which the House of Representatives would pass a relief bill that carved out states led by Democrats with policies the president objected to. I don't know whether the president believes he has it within his power to prevent maybe grant money or some kind of aid money from going to certain states. He does have the ability, for example, to decide when and when not to declare federal emergencies or disasters in certain states. But that affects the mm-hmm. people who live in those states much more so than and much more directly, you'd imagine, than the bureaucrats or the legislators who craft policies with which the president might disagree.
Yeah. I guess I remember when I sort of first became aware of the federal government tying funding to state policy. It was back in the days when there was debate about raising the age for consumption of alcohol. It had been lowered in a lot of states from 21 to 18 in the 70s. And then there was a push led by groups like Mothers Against Drunk Driving and so on to raise it back up to 21. And the federal government finally said, we're going to raise this back up to 21. And if states don't follow our lead, they're going to risk losing transportation funding. But at least there was a nexus there. You could say, okay, well, this has to do with driving, drunken driving, and as the case may be. But driving, of course, occurs on our roadways, and transportation funding pays for our roadways. So you can sort of see there is some tie between transportation funding and policy, and the age of alcohol consumption. This one, I'm struggling. I'm having a tough time figuring out how mail-in voting affects anybody's eligibility or not for or how immigration policy, frankly, how hard or how closely do your police departments cooperate with ICE? That's another one that is stuck in the president's craw. How those things are tied to economic relief on COVID-19. It's kind of a mystery. And so I don't know if folks out there have any thoughts, any possible answers to this one. Welcome to call the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV FM and AM. Stephen Portnoy, I really appreciate you joining us and digging in a little bit on the CBS News story that we saw. It's always good talking with you.
You bet, sir.
We want to bring in some folks from Lamoille County who are going to be talking with us about a situation, a difficult situation up there, in which there are folks who are in they are in a real quandary, because they've had a young man who has been doing repeated, I guess, petty crimes, you might call them, in the at least is alleged to have been doing these. I should preface that you always use the word alleged when there hasn't been a finding of guilty as yet. But and the several businesses in Johnson have been plagued by this guy. The local hardware store, Johnson Hardware and Rental, they tell me that I think he's hit them three times. And finally, a couple weeks ago, the store owner chased him down the street and tackled him after he was trying to make off with two wheelbarrows, one wheelbarrow stacked on top of another. And I think if you're trying to get away with stealing something and you're actually hoping you are going to run off with things, it's probably not a good look to be trying to push two wheelbarrows at the same time. Anyway, wanted to bring in a couple of folks here. We're hoping to get a hold of Alan Lahulier and his wife Lynn, who are the proprietors at the store in Johnson, and we're working on making that connection. And the also have on the line with us the sheriff of Lamoille County, Roger Marcoux, and the reporter at the News and Citizen who's been covering this story. That's Tommy Gardner. And of course, Tommy's a longtime voice here on WDEV. He previously was editor of the Waterbury Record, and he's moved north recently. So I want to say good morning and thanks for joining me first to Sheriff Roger Marcoux and to Tommy Gardner.
Good morning, Dave. This is Roger Marcoux, and I also have with me our state's attorney from Lamoille County, who has been good enough to come and meet with me here in my office.
Is that Todd Shove?
It is. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us as well. We got a little surprise here. So, gentlemen, let me actually start with the two law enforcement folks here, because I gather that, tell me if I've got this right, but the basic narrative here is that some of the problems that are reflected in this series of cases involving this one young 25-year-old man, these kinds of problems have been going on for a while. Well, Todd Shove, I'll start with you. Fair to say that they maybe are even exacerbated now by the fact that the court system is largely shut down and it's really hard to get the wheels of justice turning in a case of, say, the theft of a couple of wheelbarrows?
Yeah, I would say that that's fair to say. Unfortunately, the courts have essentially been shut down with the exception of the most egregious types of cases. You know, Administrative Order 49, which was administered by the Supreme Court directing our superior courts how they're going to respond to certain kinds of cases, has basically said that misdemeanor cases aren't being heard at this time. We're gearing up to get back into court starting June 3rd. So unfortunately for this person, although he's committed a number of crimes, he's been charged with a number of crimes, courts just haven't heard them yet, and they will start hearing them starting June 3rd.
Now, from what I understand, three of these crimes are at the hardware store, and there are a number of others also in Johnson. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. I mean, he's gone into the hardware store in Johnson, and he's pretty much gone into every convenience store in and around Morrisville and Johnson, and is, you know, stealing items out of the stores.
Is it your understanding, Sheriff Marcoux, that this is all in support of a drug habit?
Well, it appears that way. And as you said before, these crimes are alleged, so we have to be careful about that. But it certainly appears to us that he has an issue that we'd like to, you know, get him some help for. But he has to be on board with that.
Yeah, and so far I'm thinking that you, I don't know if, I mean, I'm sure you've had encounters with him and talked to him about, can we get you into some drug counseling, or, you know, get you onto a better path here. So far, those efforts have been rebuffed.
Yeah, one of my deputies said that he made the statement, "What's it going to take for you guys to put me in jail?" So, you know, we've taken that as a cry of, you know, help. So we've dealt with him 15, well, we've arrested him between us and surrounding police departments, we've arrested them 15 times in the last 13 months. So,
wow.
By arrest, I mean cited to court, as well as a few arrest warrants on them. So, you know,
15 times in
unless he's ready.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's not much you can do. Also, if the courts aren't ready, and if the overall justice system isn't ready to address this kind of thing. I mean, I understand that, and I don't mean to come across as completely unsympathetic to the idea of, you know, trying to reduce incarceration in Vermont and trying to not bring the hammer down on people whose main problem isn't really, a criminal mind, but it's basically oftentimes a substance dependency. But on the other hand, it sounds like from what you're saying, Sheriff Marcoux, that this guy, frankly, maybe he'd like to go to jail, because in jail you get, I guess they call it medication-assisted treatment, and you get some help, some counseling, some work by other human beings to try to help you get your life back on track. Is that right?
Well, as I said, he has made that statement before. And, he'll no sooner be cited for retail theft in one location, just walk down to the next store and walk out with a soda or whatever he wants. He's a guy, he's maybe the only guy in the world that doesn't really need any money. So, the reason that I'm here today, and I think that the state's attorney Shove is that, you know, that there has to be some protection for victims, too, on even these minor crimes, because
yeah.
What's going to happen is people are going to have enough of this and maybe deal with it in a situation where they may end up having to be arrested. Or
Tyler, I get you.
You know, he may go too far and hurt somebody else. So, I mean, the numbers are pretty significant, and we've got to come up with a way to deal with this, and it's going to take, you know, I think, a change in the law.
Yeah, I by the way, Alan and Lynn LaHoulier do join us now, and I appreciate the two of you making an appearance here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Mr. and Mrs. LaHoulier, thanks so much for joining me.
Yep, thank you.
And I wanted to one more question for the sheriff before I shift over to the LaHouliers. How much of a sheriff? How unusual is this kind of series of cases, or how unusual is this individual? This person who, do you have other people in the county there who are similar in this number of, you know, misdemeanor charges piling up in, you know, less than 2 years? How widespread a problem, I guess I'm trying to get to.
This is a bit of an anomaly here. This person's a one-man crime wave. But we have had people that have acted like this in shorter periods of time where they may be in crisis. And most of this is fueled by drugs. Substance use disorder, but people have had periods of time when over maybe a week or 2 weeks that they've just had a lot of these type of misdemeanor cases racked up against them. But this one is particularly troubling, you know, particularly for the victims like the LaHouliers, and there's no doubt that the COVID situation has played a part in it.
And Alan LaHoulier, we were talking yesterday, and you were telling me that you also have some degree of sympathy for this young man, and yet this is no way for you to live as a small, you know, owner of a small business in a small town in Vermont, right?
Well, I mean, me and my wife, you know, both feel like, you know, there's no protection for us. You know, we don't want to get violent with somebody or hurt somebody, but at some point, you know, when you're repeatedly robbed, you know, all the time, and this is not even first time from him, from other people that have, you know, just come in and robbed us of $1,000 worth of tools,
walked out the door, and we've called the police, and nothing ever happened. We never see any tools back. We never hear back from anything. And the way the law is, you know, I didn't really realize it, you know. They don't have to show up to court if they really don't want to, because this one guy stole $1,000 in tools, didn't show up to court for three times, and it was okay. It just seems like there's no accountability for these people when they do actions like this. And I feel like, you know, the victims need, you know, I don't know, victims being me and my wife, whoever business it, we need protection. We pay, you know, a lot of money in taxes and for safety, and we're not getting any of that, you know. And if something happens, it's just like, okay, well, you got stolen from, we'll write a report, and that's it. We had a restraining order against Mr. Foster, too, and that wasn't worth – I mean, you think when you have a restraining order, they would go to jail if they violate that, but nothing happened to that either.
Yeah, that's a tough situation. I mean, I sympathize with you, and I understand how you'd be pretty darn frustrated with this whole situation. Todd Shove, the state's attorney, I'm wondering if you were down at the legislature in Montpelier lobbying for any changes in Vermont's laws that might help to address repeated misdemeanor, you know, basically petty criminals, you know, at least alleged petty criminals, I should say. What would the big change be, if any?
Well, I mean, we do certainly have misdemeanor offenses that are considered predicate offenses, meaning that if you commit the same crime a second or third time or more, instance, a DUI case, the first time you get charged.
I can't hear.
The second time you get charged, excuse me, the consequences are more severe. The third time you get charged with a DUI, it becomes a felony.
Yeah, yeah.
So
okay.
Something like that could be applied to misdemeanor retail thefts or petty larcenies might be helpful. Also, you know, perhaps a change to Rule 3, which is the power of arrest statute, would be helpful so that, you know, people who are repeatedly engaging in these kind of behavior would face more serious consequences the more times they commit those particular crimes.
I wanted to help out Lynn LaHoulier here, who was complaining that she couldn't hear you, State's Attorney Shove. And Lynn, the State's Attorney was just saying a moment ago that the what he might advocate for any changes in Vermont law. I was asking him about that, and he said that he would like to see the state institute a graduated penalty for repeat offenses, so that you get tougher enforcement the longer you stay at the same line of work, shall we say. If you do one misdemeanor, it's one level. Two or three, it's the penalties stiffen. Eventually, you get to where the same kind of conduct gets you a felony charge, not just a misdemeanor charge, et cetera. And he used the example of driving while intoxicated, which, you know, I think it's a third time DUI gets you a felony charge. Is that right, State's Attorney Shove?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, a stiffening penalty as to each offense as they pile up might help to help the law enforcement and justice systems feel like they could be a little more aggressive about getting someone who is really in a real long-term repeat offender, frankly, into incarceration and or treatment. So, we've got to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. And we have, I think it's four guests now on the line talking to us about this, as one described it, a one-man crime spree in Lamoille County. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes to continue our conversation after these words from CBS and a couple of our sponsors. Stay with us, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge. Countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now.
We will get through this together.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We are back, and we have a good crew of guests on for this last half hour of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM today. We're talking about a what's been described as a one-man crime wave in Lamoille County, and joining us to talk about all of this are the owners of a hardware store, Johnson Hardware and Rental, is owned by Alan and Lynn LeHoulier. They are, I think, three-time victims of one individual who seems to be bent on stealing stuff from them, at least allegedly. All of these things are alleged. There have been I don't think, any findings of guilty in these in this current wave of crimes, but it's a lot of activity here. Also joining us, Tommy Gardner is a reporter for the News and Citizen based in Morrisville, has been covering this story, as well as joining us is Sheriff Roger Marcoux, Lamoille County, and Lamoille County State's Attorney Todd Shove. And all four of you, I really appreciate your participation. Let me go to Tommy Gardner and ask you, Tommy, to talk to us a little bit about, you had quite an extensive story, and I think you're working on a follow-up story for the News and Citizen. Is that right?
I mean, we have a little follow-up this week in the News and Citizen. But honestly, we've been writing little follow-ups for over a year, as Roger, yeah, I think, mentioned, about 15 times arrested in a little over a year. Our papers have we have a police blotters and we have a court report, so we do a pretty good comprehensive job, I think, with the cooperation of our local law enforcement officials, and the courts are super cooperative as well. And so we often can track individuals all the way from an arrest through the arraignment process to the sentencing, and this really hasn't gotten much further past this first part. And I think the pandemic really shines a little light on that. 15 times or whatever in a little over a year is a big number anyway for one person, but I'm looking over our statistics, and more than half of that's just in the last 2 months since this pandemic started. And I think it really shows the fragility of some of our systems when the pandemic puts everybody into lockdown mode and nobody can operate on all cylinders.
Tommy, how long have you been a journalist in Vermont now?
Working on 20 years. I mean, yeah, did some freelancing and whatnot, but I've been, steady career wise for about 15 years now.
Okay. Have you ever seen a case like this before where one individual is allegedly responsible for 15 misdemeanors over the course of a little more than a year, as you said?
I mean, we haven't seen that we can think of off the top of our heads, but we do certainly see, whether you, the common parlance is frequent flyers, or as you often see in law enforcement affidavits, it's a person known to law enforcement officials. So we definitely see some of these frequent guests in the police blotter and the court report. But, we've also never seen a pandemic. And so we've never,
right.
I don't think that we're seeing anybody like Mr. Foster within this pandemic, although we are seeing, some of the previous frequent flyers that we talked about pop up again. And a lot of them, from my understanding and talking with some of the law enforcement officials, is a lot of these people are transient. They're homeless, whether, you think homeless as in a homeless shelter living on the streets, or if you think homeless as in, couch surfing. And sometimes they just kind of pop up, law enforcement. And I'll let them chime in. Correct me if I'm wrong, but their spider sense, their contacts, their knowledge, they have a sense. They know that these people are around, but sometimes when they don't have an address and they don't have a phone number, oftentimes they're kind of hard to keep track of.
Yeah, yeah, and when you hear about another event of shoplifting, you think it's you're told that we recognize this guy, and you want to go find him and talk to him, maybe arrest him. There's that challenge of just, okay, so where is he? We know he's somewhere in the area, could be.
And everybody's a minor detective on social media too. I mean, I think the last time we posted that story that you mentioned a week ago, we posted the story and immediately somebody posted as a comment on our Facebook page, he just stole a bike from Big Lots, and lo and behold, Morristown police blotter shows up this week, and yes, there is a bike stolen from Big Lots. So so even people who aren't involved in law enforcement, just everyday Joes on the street are aware of this guy.
Wow, that's it's a tough situation. And Alan LaHoulier, as a victim of this thing, I certainly picked up some frustration from you as we were talking before the break, and I just wanted to touch back with you because you were also saying you do have a certain amount of sympathy for the problems of folks who are struggling with substance abuse or in the throes of it or whatever. Talk to me a little bit about that.
No, I'll let my wife talk about that.
Yeah. Okay, Lynn. Let's get Lynn on the conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I actually have a couple of things I'd like to say, but I'll go back to that. But I want to start in the beginning. From our personal experience, being stolen from three times by this guy, along with having a restraining order and having him come back for the third time, and we're pretty much helpless with him not being detained or getting any consequences for his actions, as we're just living our daily lives trying to make an income for us in the Vermont community and providing a customer service. But beyond all that, I gotta get my thoughts together here. Our personal experience has been that this is not just a COVID thing for us. We have been experiencing repeated offenses with, not necessarily particular people. And I do have, I'm kind of going all over the place here right now. It starts with first, there's no protection for people. There's no protection for people with repeated offenders with multiple misdemeanors, number one. That's my first focus in this entire thing. People can't just have people come on their lawns or their business property, stealing from them, taking away, scaring them. People are not feeling protected. And the laws need to be changed for, number one, to protect those people. But number two, on the whole flip side, and this goes back to Mr. Foster, when you have a gentleman like this or a female that is doing multiple offenses constantly, just having freelance in the community do whatever they please, infringing upon our rights and our protection. The wind might be bothering us. There's something to be called there, too. I feel like the system and the laws are being negligent to them as well, because there's no way that anybody, it could come down to maybe a mental health issue possibly. Maybe they have a drug addiction. Maybe they don't have the finances to get the help they need or the resources or the support. I'm talking about first, there's got to be consequences for these people when they violate our protections and our rights. There's got to be consequences, number one, for them. And I'm talking about detainment for especially, repeated offenders with multiple misdemeanors. And I'm saying detainment at least 3 months, possibly six. I'm not in the judicial system, so I don't know how that all logistically goes with financing and so forth. But these guys got to be first set of consequence to learn that they can't just keep on doing this, number one, to help protect us as a community and to teach them that this is not okay. And then after they're detained for such amount of time, then I think that if they get a chance to sober up or get a little bit stabilized on their feet, they might actually have a little bit of blue sky going on, where they realize, holy, this could be my connection to get some help right now for me, because I know I need it for my mental health, or I need it for my addiction problem, or my alcohol abuse, whatever it could be. And then if the state has something set up to get them to that next path where they could choose that, that's a chance. That's a sliver of hope to help clean up the streets, keep the community protected, but also helping these repeated offenders. It's just not... The system is not working for anybody right now, and something needs to be changed, and we cannot wait for, next January to March when they can pass bills. This has been going on for 2 years with this guy. Something needs to start happening now. We all can't wait another 10 months to see what Mr. Foster is going to do or anybody else.
Let me ask State's Attorney Shove, because a lot of the criticism here, Todd Shove, is the directed at the justice system in Vermont, and that it isn't set up properly, I guess, to basically respond in situations like this. What's your take on that? I mean, I would think that some in the system would be saying, you know, we have Program X, Program Y, Program Z. We do all this medication-assisted training in our facilities, medication-assisted treatment in our facilities. And so what's your perspective? Is the system as broken as the Lahuliers seem to be finding it to be?
I think, you know, our criminal justice system is about as good as it gets anywhere in the world. Unfortunately, I think this is an unusual circumstance. We're finding ourselves, you know, not only dealing with the fact that this individual is committing crimes, but he's also, you know, suffering from either substance abuse issues or mental health issues. And those are two issues that I really think, you know, our society is struggling to deal with. I think there need to be changes. There need to be more services that can be provided to people who are having those particular issues. But, you know, somebody doesn't go out and just commit 15 retail thefts without some underlying problem. And until we can address that, in addition to, you know, providing adequate consequences for that kind of behavior, you know, there definitely needs to be some changes made.
Sheriff Marcoux, same question to you. Do you think the justice system is broken?
Well, I worked in the country of Haiti for 5.5 years. Now that system is broken, and I agree with State Attorney Shove that we have one of the best systems in the world here. But we have things to get through the cracks, and this is one of them. And you know, I'm pro-victim, and, you know, I still think that I do this job to help out those people that have been victimized. And unfortunately, we just can't help and cure everybody. And if we can't, then we have to protect victims. And these are misdemeanors, and it's not the end of the world, but it certainly is a quality of life issue for many people. And as Lahuir said, they're just trying to make an honest living here. And you got to keep dealing with the same individual over and over and over again. I think that they're, as we go along in life, sometimes things have to be tweaked. And I think that this law, the Rule 3, as State's Attorney Shove indicated, there is a section in there where we could address this problem.
Give me a little more detail on that. Refresh me again. What is Rule 3 and how would you change it?
All right. Rule 3 it defines when we can arrest people. For example, we can arrest someone without a warrant for a felony offense. And we can arrest someone without a warrant for a misdemeanor offense that's been committed in the presence of a law enforcement officer. That would be like somebody asking somebody to leave their property and they refuse to do it while they're committing the offense of trespass. And if a law enforcement officer asks them and they won't leave, then they can be taken into custody. That's a misdemeanor committed in their offense. Non-witness misdemeanor offenses it gets more complicated. We're supposed to, for a non-witness misdemeanor offense, we're supposed to issue a citation to go to court at some date in the future. Now, there is some provisions of that allow for us to still take somebody into custody, even if it's non-witness, things like failure to provide satisfactory proof of identity or you know, arresting somebody so that you can have obtain a non-testimonial evidence. And then there are some non-witness misdemeanors that that you can arrest for, such as a person who has violated a stalking order, a simple assault, which is a misdemeanor, a reckless endangerment, which is a misdemeanor, cruelty to child, other misdemeanors like that. And I believe that State's Attorney Shove mentioned perhaps expanding on this section to include retail theft retail theft or some other misdemeanor type of theft violation. The way I've been thinking about this, as I've been asked by our Dan Noyes, who's our local legislator here covering Johnson, is, you know, perhaps you need something where you go, someone who has violated a provision X amount of times within X amount of time period, something along those lines that would take someone out of circulation that is just going at this every day and in lots of different locations.
Yeah. Let me ask the LaHouliers, what's the biggest change you would like to see, Lynn LaHoulier, in the justice system? Are there any particular laws you see as needing? I know you're not a lawyer, and maybe this is something you'd rather leave to the more law enforcement oriented folks here. But any specifics that you'd like to see changed in our justice system to try to put a lid on this stuff?
Yes, I would. I agree with possibly what Mr. Shove and Sheriff Marcoux are saying. There needs to be a law change for repeated offenders and multiple misdemeanors to help protect the community's safety. Number one, why am I keep having flighty thoughts right now? Hold on, I'll pass it off to my husband for a minute.
Well, I mean, my theory, what my belief is, I think the state of Vermont has a theory too. You know, these are they're treating the heroin addicts and stuff like that as it's a disease, which it is, but also is a crime. And there's no money in arresting heroin addicts. You can't get money from them. They take up, we're putting them in jail. And so I think that's one big thing. And then, like last year when we were stolen from the guy, stole $1,000 in a Sawzall, he had, he was on probation, and he robbed two more people while he was on probation beside us, and it took him 6 months to go to court, and he didn't show up three times. Now, I always thought when you were on probation, if you violated it, you went to jail. And this guy just kept on robbing people, and even though $1,000 is a felony, he still walked free. So that's kind of where we're thinking, like, why put all these conditions on releases and everything else when they never come to anything? So if Mr. Foster has all these conditions on release, like you can't steal again, or what's going to happen? You get a suspended sentence of 1 month when he does it again, and nothing happens. So why put conditions on somebody when they're never going to enforce them?
I think that's a good question. We have a listener on the line calling in to check in with us this morning. Vic from Middlesex is trying again. We had a miscommunication or something when we tried previously, but Vic, good morning. What's up with you today?
Good morning. Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
Okay. Thanks. Hey, I've been listening. I know this guy. He actually worked for me or provided a service 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think you'd have to be less than aware not to know that it was he has issues with drugs.
And okay.
His parents have spent most of their life savings trying to help him. And unfortunately, I can't do that anymore. So I don't think all the blame ought to be law-oriented. I don't think you can pass enough laws to take care of this problem any more than if the person had another disease, such as alcoholism or something like that.
I think
some of the blame or some of the fault has got to be on our therapy when they go to those places to get dried out, and they don't or can't. I mean, I think it's very hard for people to understand. I don't how hard it is to get off those drugs if you're addicted. That's why they call it addiction.
I also
don't want to take away from the Hooyers. They have their business, and I'm sure none of us would want to be stolen from. But I think maybe the drug programs, I don't know if you can force a guy to rehabilitate. I don't know. But just passing more laws doesn't seem to be the answer. It is
all right, norm. Yeah. Vic, I appreciate your call. I think you really kind of put your finger on the nub of this conundrum here, that it's just a really a difficult problem. Thank you very much for checking in this morning. Let's go back to the Hooliers for a moment and just ask, has the thought occurred to you, I mean, I'm not suggesting this, but I would imagine that some of our listeners out there may be asking a question along the lines of, is there ever a time when you sort of, for lack of a better phrase, take the law into your own hands? Go ahead.
Actually, this is Landon Allen's with me right now. And I actually want to go back to Mr. Is it Vic or Nick? I apologize, can't hear well.
Vic, yeah.
You know, I agree with him, too, on that issue. We've had personal experience with that scenario, not in our immediate family, but I'm well aware of the drug rehabilitation centers somewhat, and 30 days isn't cutting it for these guys. I think addiction has been super hard in the state of Vermont, you know, statewide, and that again brings me back to these repeated offenders with multiple misdemeanors. It's a statewide issue. It's not just Lamoille County. Down in the, Rutland, you know, elderly people are having people jump through their windows, the one window that's unlocked in their house, because they're looking for prescripts and grabbing their grocery money right off the counter. I've heard many multiple stories of this statewide. But going back to what Mr. Vic was saying was, I agree. And, you know, parents, that's, again, you know, Mr. Foster is repeating these offenses. I think, personally, I do think the guy's crying for help. I don't think he has the resources to get it. And so not only, you know, it's kind of a balanced thing. The public needs to be protected by the laws from these repeated offenders and multiple misdemeanors. And on the other side, these guys got to get detained to get a consequence, number one, for their actions, whether they're an addict, an alcoholic, or they're just making bad choices. They've got to learn that this is not okay, because that also helps protect the community for at least 3 months, if not more. And then I do agree. I think we need a better system for the rehab facilities to help these people get better. And a lot of this could be either drug-related, but it also could also be mental health right here in the state of Vermont. And I think both issues got to have better programs. But number one, there still needs to be consequences for poor actions to protect the safety of the community.
All right. Well, that sums up. Go ahead. Well,
can I add one thing quick?
Yep.
I mean, we've seen people where they've gone to, you know, they go to court for drug problems or whatever else, and they put them in a 30-day rehab.
Excuse me, I hate to do this, but I just got notified we're about out of time, unfortunately. Hey, I thank you very much, all four of you, for joining me. Tommy Gardner, Sheriff Roger Marcoux, State's Attorney Todd Shove, all five of you, I should say, and both Lou Hooliers, Alan and Lynn. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
It's going to about do it for the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM, and tune in again tomorrow morning. Meanwhile, stay tuned for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and have a great day, everybody.